One thing we're not going to talk a whole lot about tonight in our Genesis study, this is part 39, is we're not going to spend a whole lot of time in chapter 36 tonight. The reason being is because as you look at chapter 36, the very first verse is, now these are the generations of Esau, who is Edom. And while that, I'm certain, is interesting to a lot of people, it is really not relevant to a whole lot that we're studying. As we might need to, as we go through the study, we might refer back to some of the verses. What it is a genealogy of the offspring of Esau. And of course, there are some verses here that are relevant, and so we will go and take a look at those. One of the things that is relevant to the study and to your knowing is throughout the Bible, Edom is referenced. And Edom and the Edomites, of course, become a people. And as is referenced in the very first verse, Esau is Edom. And, of course, the Edomites spring from the descendants of Esau. And if you skip down to verse 6, Esau took his wives and his sons and his daughters and all the persons of his house and his cattle and all his beasts and all his substance, which he had gotten in the land of Canaan, and went into the country from the face of his brother Jacob. The reason being is because, if you remember, first of all, Jacob had sent ahead gifts of many animals and such like, and the things that he had gotten from Jacob, because Jacob feared Esau, and when the two boys met, Jacob had sent ahead those things as gifts. And of course, at this point, their father Isaac had just died. If you look back in the last verse of chapter 35, Isaac gave up the ghost and died, and Jacob and Esau collectively buried him. So there is no hint of animosity left between the two boys. So I'm not going to interject that there is any animosity or anger left between the two of them. And so we would assume, knowing that Rebekah, of course, Isaac's wife, we know that she's dead. Isaac is dead now, and so whatever animals Isaac has, whatever inheritance is there, the two of them are going to split. So that's what this is referring to. The substance that Esau gets from Canaan would be the inheritance from his father Isaac. And so he takes all that, and if you look at verse 7, because for their riches were more than they might that they might dwell together, and the land therein they were strangers could not bear them because of their cattle. So there was just too much, and somebody had to go because there was just between the two of them there was just too much. Do you remember in this study? Do you remember a similar situation? In the past, well, there was a similar situation between Abraham and his nephew Lot, where, you know, Abraham just prospered so much, and Lot, of course, because he was with Abraham, also prospered, and it came to the point where Abraham said, "Boy, we got split up. There's just too much," and you know, and Abraham gave Lot his choice of, you know, you look around and which way do you want to go. So, but so he. Thus dwelt Esau in Mount Seir, and Esau, again, states that Esau is Edom. Well, there comes a time when Edom and some of the, many of the descendants of Esau become a problem for the offspring of what we know to become the nation of Israel. Or those who are known as Israel, and that in the past and or the future. But meanwhile, there are developments along the way, and I just wanted to kind of highlight some of those so that you're aware of some of the things that go on in the Bible here. The land of Seir, where Esau claimed his dominion, was not to be a part of Israel's inheritance. If you remember, Ishmael, who was Isaac's son, was given inheritance, was actually promised inheritance by God. He was to, 12 princes were to come from him, and he was to have inheritance because Abraham besought God on the part of Ishmael. Well, no one besought God on the part of Esau, but Esau went off to Seir to settle down. And here God intercedes on the part of Esau anyway. Really, if you compare the two brothers, Esau and Jacob, if you'd known them both, probably Esau would have been the more likable of the two. You know, he's just a more likable type of guy. More friendly, more likable, more outgoing, more, you know, just... frankly, Jake, you know, thus I guess showing that not every member of God's church, you know, the body of Christ, is a really nice, likable, you know, personality type of person, you know. Basis God is gracious, and you know, it's one of those things that, you know, when Paul says, Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated. You know, Jacob was, you know, when we think of Jacob as being the more spiritual one, you know, all through Jacob's life, you know, we've disproven that whole theory. He was not always all that spiritual. Matter of fact, he was very unspiritual a lot of his life. But yet, Jacob, God loved Jacob. You know, God had his own reasons. Esau was not a very spiritual person, that he disregarded his birthright and disregarded the covenant that, you know, was given to his father Isaac and you know, spiritual things. But meanwhile, God looked after Esau. And here in Deuteronomy chapter 2, starting in verse 1, you see... this is as Joshua is leading the Israelites into the promised land. It says, "Then we turned and took our journey into the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea, as the Lord spake unto me, and we compassed around Seir, Mount Seir, many days." So this is the same place where Esau had gone back to. "And the Lord spake unto me, saying," of course this is years later, "And the Lord spake unto me, saying, ye have compassed this mountain long enough. Turn ye northward, and command thou the people, saying, ye are to pass through the coast of your brethren, the children of Esau." So notice what they're called, your brethren, "which dwell in Seir, and they shall be afraid of you. Take ye good heed unto yourselves, therefore, meddle not with them. For I will not give you of their land, no, not so much as a foot breadth, because I have given out Seir unto Esau for possession." So God gave that to Esau and his descendants, even without any interceding from Jacob or anyone else. So now, if you read chapter 36, and of course, you know, I'm going to advise you to do so. It's just not great teaching. One of the offspring of Esau in particular would cause a lot of trouble for the nation of Israel. And if you look at verse 12, "And Timnah, the concubine to Eliphaz," which is Esau's son, "and she bare to Eliphaz Amalek." And that name will come up over and over and over in the Bible, Amalek. And these were the sons of Adah, Esau's wife. So it was a concubine of Esau's son, not a you know, like a slave girl, that type of thing. And Amalek became a great enemy of the nation of Israel. And you see in Exodus chapter 17, verse 8, then came Amalek and fought with Israel and wrestled with him. And you find the prophecy about God destroying Amalek, the strongest of them, one of the strongest being Deuteronomy 25:19. Therefore it shall be when the Lord thy God hath given thee rest from all thine enemies round about in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance to possess it, that thou shalt blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. Thou shalt not forget it. So, and that comes up over and over and over, the name Amalek, and how God so much hates those people. And Psalm 83, which is somewhat infamous in that, you know, they're all these the 10 countries that are confederate against Israel. They're all Arab countries. Amalek is one of them that is among those 10, the children of Amalek. So they're still around. God hasn't blotted them out yet, but the children of Amalek is one of the 10 that's mentioned in Psalm 83. And so God has not blotted them out yet. So they're still around. And but meanwhile, it's just it's interesting that how things work out. But Genesis 36, like I say, it's tough slog through a genealogy, and by the time we got to the end of it, you'd all be asleep. So and it means very little. But there are things in there, but we'll refer back to whatever needs to be referred back to. For instance, in First Chronicles, you find that there was actually chronicled the dukes and kings that were in that particular area that ruled over that particular area before Esau came in and settled there. So, you know, even that is chronicled. But the names, who knows what they, you know, who the people were. We don't have pictures or anything, so I couldn't begin to explain who those people are. But anyway, so we move on to Genesis chapter 37, and there we actually pick up some meaning to things we can relate to. As I mentioned last week, that we have the boys, the 12 boys, and one of the things we don't want to do is forget that Jacob is still around, and he is. So this is not really a story about Joseph. This is one of the things that people start to think, that this is a story about Joseph. And it's not. It's really the life and times of Jacob. But the boys become more and more prevalent in the story of Joseph, or of Jacob, I'm sorry. Because Jacob is around until the very end of, until almost the very end of Genesis. So, but the boys become more and more prevalent, because what is happening is God is forming a nation out of the 12 boys, the 12 brothers, the offspring of Jacob. And of course that would become the nation of Israel, the 12 tribes. And so we're in chapter 37, we're going to go through that, and hopefully you'll see some things that maybe you've never thought of before, and see that, because the story will more than likely be familiar. So hopefully I'll bring it to you in a way that maybe you'll think of it in a different way than you thought about it before. Here in Genesis 37:1, Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. So that he's back where Abraham and Isaac both lived, and obviously my note here is wrong. Joseph this is where Joseph comes into the story. Joseph is, of course, the second youngest of all the boys, Benjamin being the youngest, and Joseph, remember, is Rachel's son, Rachel being the favorite wife of Jacob, the one that he absolutely just head over heels with when he first saw her as he was on his way to Laban's, stay with Laban, Uncle Laban. And so as we pick up the story of Joseph, what we find is, let's read the verse here, verse 2. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph being 17 years old. Now, note that he was 17 years old. And we don't think of 17 as being all that old, really, do we? It's not even old enough to vote. But when you think about it, in the Bible, at 17, I can find you in the Bible that there was kings of entire countries that were younger than 17 years old. At 17, there were young men that were making military decisions that affected entire countries, and 17 was a grown-up age at that particular time. Young ladies were getting married by the time they were 14, sometimes even younger than that. So 17 was a man at that particular time. So that kids were made to grow up older at that time. So he was 17, and he was feeding the flocks with his brethren. And notice who he was with. He was the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. Now, if you remember who Bilhah and Zilpah were, they were both concubines. They were both the slave girls to Leah and Rachel. Leah and Rachel being the actual daughters of Laban. So, they were, you hate to label people, but I'm going to. They were actually lesser sons in that they were the sons of concubines, not the sons of the actual daughters of Laban. So you just need to realize that's exactly who they were. They were raised by slave girls and not girls who were the daughters of Laban. Because the fact of the matter is this. There's a difference in how children are raised, who they're raised by, how they turn out. Is that not true? I mean, you can see that anywhere. How children are raised depends on how they turn out. Well, the same is true here in the story. The mother of the children, there was four mothers involved, Leah, Rachel, Bilhah, and Zilpah. There's four mothers, and then between those four, there was 12 children. Well, what we're going to find out is the mother of the children made a difference. Not all 12 of them turned out the same, and the mother made a difference. Well, Joseph brought unto their father an evil report. Well, Joseph is with the children of the two concubines, actually shepherding over those sons. He's in charge of them, watching. He's like their boss at 17 years old. And well, that's going to cause some animosity, isn't it, Sermon? You're at work and you've been there for 35 years, and then they hire some kid and that's 18 years old, green, and they put him in charge of you. Right. Yeah, you're going to have a little bit of animosity and whatnot toward that kid. Well, that's what's going on here. That's what's going on here. There's more to the story. There's more to the story. Remember Reuben, the oldest child? Do you remember what he did?
He tried to take one of
his father's concubines. He tried to take one of the, I think it was Bilhah. He tried to take one of them. As a matter of fact, he laid with her in a power grab. And it's not until chapter 49 that we find out that Jacob, he takes away the firstborn, the firstborn's, the rights of the firstborn. from Reuben. Well, what we don't know yet is that the birthright has been given to Joseph. It's just, it hasn't formally been given to him. But what is happening is Jacob is handing him the firstborn's power over the other boys. See, Reuben would normally carry the big stick and be given the power over the other 11. But what's going on is Jacob is giving Joseph, who is the oldest of Rachel, the big stick, and giving him the power over the 11. And I know that because, and you got to get your Bible out, look at 1 Chronicles. Look at 1 Chronicles chapter 5. Chronicles chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. It says, "Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel," of course that's Jacob, "for he was the firstborn," that's Reuben was the firstborn, "but forasmuch as he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given unto the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, and the genealogy is not to be reckoned after the birthright." So in other words, the genealogy is not to be reckoned in the order of the birthright. "For Judah prevailed above his brethren, and of him came the chief ruler," that would be Christ, "but the birthright was Joseph's." The birthright was Joseph's. So in other words, Jacob gave Reuben's birthright to Joseph. Well, he hasn't done that yet, formally. He doesn't do that until chapter 49. But he's already giving the power of the birthright to Joseph here in letting him wield power over his brothers. So his intentions are being made known in the preeminence over his brothers. Well, there's ways that's been made known. We've all heard of the coat of many colors. This wonderful coat of many colors. What significance does that have? You have white collar workers where you work and blue collar workers. What's the difference? What's a white collar worker mean? And he's a desk jockey, right?
Yeah, no heavy lifting.
No heavy lifting. And the blue collar workers, they're the grunts, right? Well, this coat of many colors, he was the white collar worker. He was the guy that was in command of everybody. So he had the authority. And the fact that Jacob loved him more than everybody else was no secret. Look at verse 3, Genesis chapter 37. "Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors." Now, this is not any kind of conjecture on my part, because this is about this coat of many colors, because I can read 2 Samuel chapter 13. In 2 Samuel 13, you find another coat of many colors, the only other one in the Bible. 2 Samuel 13, verses 18 and 19, "She had a garment of diverse colors upon her." Now, this is the daughter of David. "For with such robes were the king's daughters that were virgins appareled. Then his servants brought her out and bolted the door after her. And Tamar put ashes on her head and rent her garment of diverse colors that was on her. And she laid her hand on her and she went on crying." Well, the crying and all that didn't mean anything. But the fact of the matter was, she was royalty. And because she was royalty, she had on a coat of many colors. It was a symbol of power. It was a symbol of power. And that's why Jacob had that coat given to his son. It was a symbol of power, just like being a white-collar worker today is. So this jealousy was caused by Jacob giving him the power over his other brothers, and that made them hate him. Verse 4, and when the brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. They were jealous. It was all, that's all it came down to. They were jealous. Envious. Well, and it didn't help the fact that Joseph then has a dream. Joseph has a dream. So it's in verse 5 through 9. Joseph dreamed a dream. And, dummy, he tells his brothers. That's the last thing. This is if you're in this position, this is the last thing you want to do. If you're a white collar worker, you don't and have a dream like this, you don't want to tell everybody. But Joseph does anyway. So he told it to his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said unto them, hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose, and also stood upright. And behold, your sheaves stood round about, and made obeisance to my sheaf. In other words, they bowed down to my sheaf. And his brethren said to him, shalt thou indeed reign over us, or shalt thou indeed have dominion over us? And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words. And he dreamed yet another dream, and told it to his brethren, and said, behold, I have dreamed a dream more. And behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me. Now, who would the sun and the moon be? The sun and the moon is mom and dad. So he tells that to his mom, he tells that to Jacob. And it didn't go over very well with daddy either. So in verse 10, he told it to his father and to his brethren. And his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee and to the earth? And his brothers envied him. But his father observed the same. So even though Jacob rebuked him, saying, what is this? Are your brothers and your mom and me going to bow down to you? Jacob observed it and he paid attention to it. He never said there's no way in the on God's green earth that this is ever going to happen. Made his brothers mad, made his brothers envious, made his brothers jealous. But Jacob observed and said, I wonder what the meaning of this is. Well, as a type of Christ, and as we go through the story that is, Joseph, that deals with Joseph, there is almost no better character in the Bible that is more a type of Christ than Joseph. And it just, there truly is not. Joseph is more a type of Christ than any other person in the Bible. But Joseph is a messenger of a message. Just like Mike is a messenger of a message, Robert is a messenger of a message, Thurman, and Stephen, they were all messengers of a particular message. And when somebody is rejecting that message, are they rejecting you?
No,
they're not. They're rejecting the originator of that message. So who are they really rejecting?
Christ.
They're rejecting God. That's right. So as a type of Christ, when they reject the message of Joseph, and they reject the authority given to Joseph, here's Jacob, and he gives Joseph authority over his brothers, and the brothers are rebelling against Joseph, and hate and envy Joseph. Who are the brothers really rebelling against?
God.
Not God.
Jacob.
Because Jacob is the one who gave Joseph the authority. And so, just like as in Christ, I mean, look at Matthew 7, verse 28 and 29. You know, when the Lord came, He came and taught with authority, and those who heard Him were amazed at the authority that He had. It came to pass when Jesus had ended these sayings, the people were astonished at His doctrine, for He taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. See, the scribes would teach. The scribes would teach, but they didn't have the same authority as Christ did, because where did His authority originate with? With the Father. Where did Joseph's authority originate with?
His
Father. Exactly right. So the scribes would envy Christ, just like the Joseph's brothers envied Joseph. And they question then the origination of His authority. Where did your authority come from? Matthew 21, 23. And when He was coming to the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people came unto Him as He was teaching and said, "By what authority dost thou do these things? And who gave thee this authority?" You know, why? You know, who gave you all this authority? Even though they had heard the message, they had heard the product, they had heard the authority for themselves. Who gives you this authority to speak this way? They're not rejecting the messenger. They're rejecting the originator of the authority, and that being God. So by rejecting the authority given to Joseph, they're rejecting Jacob, who had given him his place of authority. So the brothers develop a plot. Because, of course, if you have someone over you who has authority and you want to get rid of him, you have to plot to get rid of him, don't you? The brothers, if you remember what happened in Shechem? Remember what happened in Shechem? That's where Dinah, Jacob's daughter, was taken and defiled. And so the brothers went in and massacred all the men of Shechem. And then they took the women and children. So his brethren, Genesis 37:12, went to feed their father's flock in Shechem, which is about 50 miles from where they are. About 50 miles from where they're at. So, being the overseer of his brethren, of course, Jacob wants Joseph to go and check on the flocks and check on the brothers to make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, and the flocks are all right, that there's no shenanigans going on. He wants, just like a supervisor, go out, make sure everything's going all right, and come back and report to me. So, verse 13, "And Israel said unto Joseph, Do not thy brethren feed the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send thee unto them. And he said to him, Here am I. And he said to him, Go, I pray thee, see whether it be well with thy brethren, and well with the flocks, and bring me word again. So he sent him out of the vale of Hebron, and he came to Shechem." Now, if you were going to Shechem, of course, and you were a responsible person, you probably would not go lightly, knowing what had happened some years before. Of course, you're going into what would be really considered enemy territory. And that's why you read out of the veil of Hebron, because you're leaving the veil of protection there, really. And so Joseph gets to Shechem, and there's no one there. And he finds out that the brothers had moved even farther away from Hebron, about 20 miles farther, to Dothan. And a certain man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field, and the man asked him, saying, "What seekest thou?" And he said, "I seek my brethren. Tell me, I pray thee, where they feed their flocks." And the man said, "They are departed hence, for I heard them say, Let us go to Dothan." And Joseph went after his brethren and found them in Dothan. Now, no doubt, Joseph had on his coat of many colors, which is not great camouflage. And no doubt the brothers could see him coming from quite a ways off because of that particular coat of many colors, bright as it was. And so when they saw him afar off, even before he came near to them, they conspired against him to slay him. And they said one to another, "Behold, this dreamer cometh. Come now, therefore, and let us slay him, and cast him into some pit, and we will say some evil beast hath devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams." So, of course, one way to fix the problem would have been to dispatch Jacob, because that would have been the originator of the authority. But rather than that, they decided, "We're going to take it out on Joseph, who is the object of our animosity, because he is the one who's doing in our eyes all the dirty work, and so we're going to kill him and tell a lie about what happened, and we'll see what happens then to all these big dreams that he's having." Now, in the course of events, the two that step up to change the plan are two from the same mother. And really, one of the two you wouldn't even suspect. Reuben and Judah are both sons of Leah. They're both the two oldest and two the sons of Leah. Certainly, I can't make either of them heroes by any stretch of the imagination. Reuben really... he probably has ulterior motives for what he seeks to accomplish. He probably wants to try to regain his birthright in the eyes of his father. Judah, as you'll see, has nothing but a profit motive on his mind. But those two are both the sons of Leah, and at least they're not bloodthirsty like the rest of them. Benjamin being the only other son of Rachel, of course, he's the youngest. He's going to be younger than 17. He's the youngest of all. I can't imagine him having much of a say in anything. So, yeah, he's just probably there for and is following along. Yeah, pretty much forced to do whatever the rest of the brothers agree to. So, really, you have most of the brothers, the sons of the concubines. And again, I would point to their upbringing. If you remember when God told Jacob to go to Bethel, what was the first thing that he told the family to do? He told them all to get rid of their household gods and to get rid of their earrings, and we're going to bury them under the oak tree before we go see God at Bethel. So obviously there was a lot of paganism going on, and we know that Rachel had stolen the household gods, and you know that there was just a lot of poor upbringing, more than likely, the two concubines were pagan, and those sons probably didn't know a whole lot about God to begin with. So, you can attribute at least this partially the intervention of Reuben and Judah to their mother's upbringing, if nothing else. They weren't as bloodthirsty as the rest of them. The rest of them were just, we'll kill him and throw him in a pit. And at least Reuben and Judah intervene to the point that Joseph isn't killed. That's the only thing I can say about it. Not, I can't make them heroes, but I can say that at least Joseph wasn't killed. So, Reuben does try to save him and return Joseph to Jacob. And again, I would say it's probably for his own benefit. Probably to try to look good in Jacob's eyes. But Reuben heard it, verse 21, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, let us not kill him. And Reuben said unto them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit that is in the wilderness, and lay no hand upon him, that he might rid himself out of their hands to deliver him to the father, to his father again. So that was Reuben's intervention before Jacob got there, and the brothers agreed to that. And it came to pass when Joseph was come unto his brethren that they stripped Joseph out of his coat of many colors that was on him. Interesting that that's the first thing that they do. The very symbol of authority that Joseph has as he comes up to his brothers, the very first thing they do is they strip him of that symbol of authority. You're no longer over us, little man. And they take, you know, rip that coat right off of him. And then they take him and they throw him in the pit. And they took him and cast him into a pit. And by the grace of God, the pit was empty and there was no water in it. Most pits would have been dug to be wells. You're out in the desert, in the wilderness, and there's really no reason to be digging a pit other than to be digging a well to find water. But by the grace, like I say, by the grace of God, this one was empty. There was no water in it. Otherwise, Jacob would have drowned if there were anything or anyone came to guide him. Now, it was Reuben's intention. You can see the intention. It was Reuben's intention was to draw the brothers away from the pit so that he could then circle back, get Joseph, and take Joseph himself back to Jacob. Say, I've saved Jacob or Joseph from a certain death at the hands of his brothers. So he left the group. And the group sits down to eat. And while Reuben's gone, the group sits down to eat. And the group and they sat down to eat bread, and they lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels bearing spicery and balm and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. And this is when Judah comes up with his big idea. Rather than just leave him in the pit to die, he says, well, maybe we should make a profit on the scrawny little kid. He said unto his brethren, what profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. And his brethren were content. Then there passed by the Midianites, merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Joseph into Egypt. So, Reuben then doubles back. Reuben doubles back. And he goes back to the pit, fully expecting Joseph to be there. Fully expecting Joseph to be there. The brothers are gone. And he expects Joseph to be there. He's going to get Joseph out of the pit, pull Joseph up, take Joseph back to Jacob, save Joseph from certain death, save the day, reclaim his birthright, be the big hero. But he gets back to the pit. And Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, and he rent his clothes. And he returned unto his brethren and said, "The child is not, and I, whither shall I go? What shall I do?" In other words, so his plan didn't go so well. He had no idea what happened to Jacob. So they had the coat of Jacob, and they come up with a plan. And the plan is, it's almost deliciously ironic, I suppose, because if you remember when Rebecca, Isaac's wife, decided that Jacob and her would deceive Isaac into having Isaac give Jacob the blessing instead of giving Esau the blessing. And remember, they took the skin. Rebecca had the skins all ready to go. And remember what kind of skins they were? She dressed him up back here in Genesis chapter 27, verse 16. And she put the skins of the kids of the goats upon his hands and upon the smooth of his neck. And she gave the savory meat and bread which she had prepared in the hand of her son Jacob. So she took goat skins. And Jacob used goat skins to fool Isaac, to deceive him. So years and years and years before, he'd used the skins of goats to deceive his father, and now his boys are going to use the blood of goats to deceive him. So they took Jacob's coat, a kid of the goats, and dipped the coat in the blood. And they sent the coat of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, "This have we found. Know now whether it be thy son's coat or no." And here's the amazing thing. The brothers never even had to tell a lie. They didn't have to make up a story. They didn't have to tell a lie. They didn't have to say a word. All they did was let Jacob come to his own conclusion about what had happened. Just as Isaac, years and years before, had come to his own conclusion about who Jacob was. Verse 33, "And he knew it, and said, 'It is my son's coat. An evil beast hath devoured him. Joseph is without doubt rent in pieces.'" So without even so much as a suggestion of what could have happened, what did happen, or anything else, Jacob came to the conclusion that that was his son's coat, that an evil beast devoured him, and that Joseph is without doubt rent into pieces and is dead. "And Jacob rent his clothes and put sackcloth upon his loins and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, I will go down into the grave unto my son mourning. Thus his father wept for him. Meanwhile, yes, they did. They did lie. Yeah, they knew it was Joseph's coat. You're right. But they didn't have to. They didn't have to say that they killed him or that they didn't kill him. They just let Jacob come to his own conclusion about what happened. Meanwhile, the good news is that Joseph is still in the care of God. And God's providential care was such that his purpose would be worked out through all the events that would happen. And he ended up in Egypt, of course, but he ended up in one of the homes of one of the most responsible officers in Pharaoh's government. And of course, that is an extremely interesting story that we'll begin to look at. In the last verse in chapter 37, the Midianites sold him into Egypt unto Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's and captain of the guard. So that is where Jacob is, and he is alive and very well. And of course, Jacob and the boys all, Jacob thinks he's dead. The boys know not where he's at, but think they're done with him forever. And we'll pick up the story there again next week.